Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. We are in the spooky season, the hinge of the year, the time of monsters. The monsters take many forms. There are monsters killing populations, quickly with bombs and guns, or slowly, with unchecked disease and deprivation of water, food, housing, and medical care, with environmental damage and trauma. There are monsters stealing land and resources and murdering those who get in the way. There are monsters telling you that there's nothing to be done about any of this, and that such monstrosity is fine and normal and inevitable. There are monsters misleading us about who the monsters are. But here on the Old Mole, we try to show the ways that the monstrosity has come about, because we need to understand the world in order to change it. We try to show the ways that people have resisted monsters, the ways that people can come together to help each other, to organize, to challenge the monstrosities, and to ensure that the new world can be born. On today's show, we hear about responding to attacks on public education, representing the horrors of U.S. settler colonialism, and about understanding the horrors of neocolonialism in the Middle East. Bill Resnick talks to Jennifer Berkshire, a teacher, podcaster, and journalist, and co-author with Jack Schneider of A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School, published in 2020, and of The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, coming out in 2024 from New Press. In part one of their conversation, Bill and Jennifer talked about the right-wing attack on public education to replace it with private voucher schools teaching the right's ideas on patriotism, sexual morality, and the obligations of citizenship, and the disastrous outcomes of that attack. You can find a link to that discussion on our KBOO webpage. Today, in part two, they discuss how the attack has triggered a nationwide backlash with the potential of greatly strengthening public schools. Then, Jan Hocken and Kaylee Simmons discuss the film Killers of the Flower Moon, directed by Martin Scorsese. The film is based on the 2017 nonfiction book by David Gunn and tells the story of the Osage tribe during an era when the discovery of oil on tribal lands in Oklahoma leads to wealth for Osage members and a series of tragedies, including horrific killings. Dr. Simmons, Oglala Lakota, is an assistant professor of Indigenous Nation Studies at Portland State University. In her research and teaching, she examines representations of Indigenous peoples in popular culture with an emphasis on the genres of horror and ethnography. Finally, Patricia Kullberg looks at the story behind the story of the devastating violence unfolding in the Middle East. Some analysts argue the conflict is fueled by the neocolonial strategy of suppressing progressive voices in favor of extremist regimes that the U.S. or its proxies can either crush or control. Kullberg reads excerpts from an article by author and commentator Mehdi Hassan titled How Israel Went from Helping Create Hamas to Bombing It, published in The Intercept in 2018. She follows with excerpts from Stephen Zunis's article published this past month in The Progressive, Hamas, Israel, and the U.S. Have Learned Nothing. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of this show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show. If you're interested in getting involved with The Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at oldmolevarietyhour, all one word, @gmail.com. And remember, you can support your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. First up, Bill Resnick talks with Jennifer Berkshire.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour for KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Jennifer Berkshire, a journalist, a teacher of journalism, a specialist in schools, has written 2 books and countless articles. So Jennifer, before your upcoming book, much of your writing warned us of the potential demolition of the U.S. public school system, that the enemies of public education were on a roll, succeeding, convincing the citizenry that the schools were broken and had to be completely replaced. Your upcoming book, The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, it will be published next year, discusses how progressives can defeat the hard right, not a warning, but a call to action. And your recent article in Nation magazine was subtitled, I quote, How the Right School-Themed Extremism Has Triggered a Nationwide Backlash. Tell us that story of the parental left, those of us, a majority who've been convinced that the school system is broken. They like their local teachers and they like the schools. Tell us the story of the left and left parents fighting back.
Well, so I have some good news for you and some bad news. Which do you want first?
I always like happy endings.
All right. Well,
give me the bad news. I'll grit my teeth.
So a lot of what I've been doing over the last couple of years is just making the case in whatever forum I can that we're getting this story about parents' rights all wrong. And I'll give you a classic example. So I live in the Boston area. Our newspaper of record is the Boston Globe. And a couple of weeks ago, they had a front page story above the fold about how Nikki Haley, who's running for president, was going to be campaigning in New Hampshire with this group, Moms for Liberty, and that she was really going to be leaning into this parents' rights issue and what a big issue this is and how, you know, like Democrats are really on their heels. Well, you know, I know enough. I've paid close enough attention to New Hampshire politics to know that this issue has been a complete loser for Republicans, that they have lost election after election. New Hampshire has the biggest state legislature in the country. They have 400 people in their state legislature. And of the recent special elections, the Republicans have lost all of them. And a big part of that is that they have embraced this very extreme rhetoric around parents' rights, the school culture wars, and school privatization. And so it never made any sense to me that this was going to be the issue that brought the Bourbon women in particular back into the fold after they left the party during the Trump years. Because if you look at the actual polls, things like book banning are wildly, wildly unpopular across party lines, right? At a time when we really don't agree on anything, opposition to book banning is uniquely unifying. And so as the parents' rights discourse has gotten more and more extreme, it seemed really kind of hard to believe that this was going to be an issue that really rallied people, let alone prompted people who had fled the party during the Trump years to come back. And so what you find is that since Glenn Youngkin won that election, surprise election in Virginia, there is not a single example of a candidate running on parent rights and attracting Democratic voters. We can see that the school board races around the country, the sort of Moms for Liberty candidates and the parents' rights candidates, they lose about 70% of the time. That's really important to know. And all of that is really good news. The bad news is that there are definitely communities where this issue remains explosive, and it's not always in the kind of red state areas that you might think of. I've argued, you know, over and over again that one of the things that Glenn Youngkin did so effectively in Virginia was that he really mobilized affluent parents who were intent on getting their kids into the elite magnet school in Northern Virginia, and then from there onto the Ivy League. And so he understood that the anxiety of those parents is a really potent political force. And that actually is where we've seen the culture war stuff deployed the most effectively. In, for example, the San Francisco school board race, saw something similar happening in New York City. And that's where any policy that stresses equity or argues in favor of getting rid of, say, gifted and talented programs, or changes the admission criteria, these elite schools where kids have to take a test in order to get in, it's when you threaten those kinds of programs in the name of equity that particular parent constituency really gets activated. And I've been really surprised that you don't see more Republicans learning from Youngkin's lesson, because you really don't. Instead, they're hammering themes that get more extreme by the day. So one piece of bad news is that this stuff remains very potent. It's just not necessarily in the places that we tend to associate with the culture wars. And then the other thing I think people really need to be careful about, you described what our book is doing, is laying out a map for progressives. And I think one lesson that is hard to get through to people is that we have to be so careful about keeping our public schools partisan free zones. And that if you actually talk to organizers on the ground who have successfully pushed back and defeated candidates from the right, it's because they have laid out a vision that's big and expansive, but it's also scrupulously nonpartisan, because our schools require that all kinds of parents believe in them. And if they come to be branded as just blue or just red, it's over. You know, it's a hard lesson for us. And I notice that, like, whenever I write something for a progressive publication about this, you know, they want to put progressive in the title, right? Like, progressives win school board elections. But that's not actually what we're seeing. We're seeing that big coalitions are coming together to defeat extremism, but that the success of the coalitions depends on being bigger than just having a D next to the name.
You described an electorate that rejects the extreme and ridiculous positions of the hard right, with Texas and Florida banning any discussion sympathetic to nonconforming sexuality, or also banning critical race theory, which I interviewed Jesse Hagopian a couple months ago, who pointed out critical race theory really reaches out to whites by celebrating John Brown. But still, they're angry that especially blacks have become citizens and complain. I think the good news that these radical right crazies are offensive to most people and are voted down, that's surely true. But I think those people, the radical righties, have made a victory that I'm afraid that progressives will be very hard to overcome, because they have really, in articles in Rethinking Schools and in Political, have made this point that the hard right has intimidated teachers. Their attacks on public schools and individual teachers is, of course, in the education community very, very well known. And the teachers who in some way or other come to the hard right's attention will see themselves as vulnerable and easy to attack and completely disrupt their teaching and lives. Teachers have mortgages and need to save for their, again, the economy, need to save for their kids' education. So most will likely, and this is the argument that Rethinking Schools and Political writers, that they'll likely adapt and make sure that there is nothing to attack. And I'm afraid that the right has had really enduring influence on the curriculum, and they will continue to police teachers and curriculums that deviate from their political positions, that is, the right wings. I think this is going to take a long time to defeat. What's your sense of that, and how would it be done?
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's very instructive to look at history, because, you know, we fight over schools in this country again and again. And one of the lessons, like if you look, for example, at how, you know, what the John Birch Society did, the extreme right group that, you know, they put a lot of emphasis on schools. And, you know, it really, you didn't have to have that many people who were the sort of, you know, the extreme people who were threatening teachers and always about to expose some outrage happening in the schools. And it really, you only had to have like a handful of people in order for them to have an impact, that, you know, like teachers would end up leaving, superintendents would get hounded out of their jobs, and that eventually what you saw happen was something very similar to what we're seeing now, where you get a broad enough coalition that forms at the local level and says, enough, not in our community. But there was damage done, just as you were saying. And the teacher shortage was real before all of this started. And, you know, you look at like these polls that show that parents don't want their kids to be teachers, and that current teachers say that they wouldn't advise their own kid to become teachers. These states where there are all-out wars happening over what gets taught, and you have had laws enacted that basically incentivize parents and even people who don't have kids in the schools to file lawsuits against individual schools and school leaders and individual teachers and librarians. All of that is going to be really damaging in the short term and hard to undo in the long term. And I think that, you know, ultimately what is going to make the difference is that parents who may have been willing to go along with the first round of this, you know, maybe they got worked up over quote unquote critical race theory, but at some point they start to worry that all of these laws limiting what teachers can teach and what libraries can keep on the shelves and what kids can discuss in class, they start to worry that those laws are going to constrain their kids' opportunities in the future. And we're already seeing this in Florida, think about how, you know, like Ron DeSantis has really tried to make political hay out of the AP African American History course, which is a course that realistically very few kids in Florida were ever going to take. So perfect target for him to say, give a speech about it and just say the word woke over and over again. But then DeSantis decides that, you know, he's not going to just stop there. He's going to go to war against the entire advanced placement system. Well, Florida has something like 450,000 kids enrolled in AP classes, and parents view those classes as a way for those kids to get ahead and to save money when they get to college. And so suddenly DeSantis's campaign against woke doesn't look so appetizing. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more stuff like that.
Those economic considerations, again, raised in people's calculations.
Yeah, like it's the economic stuff, but it's also the point at which the culture war starts to constrain kids' futures. And, you know, we've seen this happen before in places like Kansas, where the schools become the focus of an ideological experiment. And then, you know, parents, suburban parents, start to see that classes are getting bigger, teachers are leaving, you know, there are fewer classes being offered, and it becomes personal. And then that drives the backlash. And I, you know, I'm really holding out hope that we're going to see something similar with these culture war issues.
Yeah. One final note, Jennifer Berkshire, I have a suggestion. So your upcoming book sounds like just what we need. It's very valuable, full of interesting and inspiring stories. This is what I gather. And also a reference book for supporters of public education, of strategies and actions for saving our public schools, even more for strengthening our schools by developing more interesting and engaging curricula and methods of active learning. Am I right about your book?
You're right about a lot of it. We really set out to help people understand why it is that we're always fighting about schools, why we're fighting about them now, what makes this moment different, and what it looks like in places where people are pushing back effectively.
You just heard part two of an interview with Jennifer Berkshire on defeating the hard right effort to force the public schools to teach the right wing's version of truth and morality. Her upcoming book, Education War, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual.
If you see me stumble, don't stand back and look on. Reach out now, brother. Give your hands to struggle.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and on this day of the spooky season, we are hearing about monsters and how to fight them. You just heard some of Give Your Hands to the Struggle from Sweet Honey in the Rock, and before that, Bill Resnick talking with Jennifer Berkshire about fighting back against right-wing attacks on public education. Both parts of that interview, along with the rest of our shows, can be found on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Patricia Kullberg with some history of how Hamas became the force it is and U.S. complicity in the problems it presents. We turn now to a discussion of representation of another painful history, the violence that settlers inflicted on Osage people after oil was discovered on their lands, revisited in the new film Killers of the Flower Moon. Now here's Jan Hocken discussing the film with Professor Kaylee Simmons.
Welcome to KBOO, Dr. Kaylee Simmons, Assistant Professor of Indigenous Nations Studies at Portland State University and scholar focused on representations of Native peoples in popular culture, including in the genre of horror. It's delightful to have you on the Old Mole Variety Hour today to talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, certainly a horror story based on history. The new feature film directed by Martin Scorsese, based on the 2017 book of the same title by David Gran, The film recounts the horrific story of the Reign of Terror in 1920s Oklahoma, a bloody chapter in American history when dozens of Osage natives were murdered in a conspiracy by white settlers to steal the oil-rich land underneath their feet. Kaylee Simmons, let's start with you talking a bit about your own work and how you approach a film like this, your own criteria for evaluating Killers of the Flower Moon as a film project.
Yeah, Wopila, thanks for having me. Kaylee Simmons, Amachiaki, Oyate, Mithawa, Ogallala Lakota. Hi, I'm Kaylee Simmons. I'm Ogallala Lakota. Like you said, I work at Portland State University. And I guess I want to start off by sort of foregrounding that my view of the film comes from my experience as a scholar of Indigenous film history. So thinking about how Native people have been represented and represented themselves in cinema for 100 years. And I think I'd be remiss not to start off by sort of pointing people in the direction of some Osage voices first. There's been a lot of responses to this film, and I wanna make sure that in these conversations that the Osage voices don't get buried, because I think they are the ones that we should be centering. So there's a really great review of the film by a wonderful Osage scholar named Jean Dennison that just came out in Time magazine. There is a really wonderful article by Joel Robinson that was in Slate, who is also Osage. There's a really wonderful piece by amazing field-defining Osage scholar Robert Warrior, who's Osage and sort of helped start the Native American Studies Association here in North America. And then also, if we're thinking locally, Cindy Lou Coleman, who we wanted to have on the show but couldn't for scheduling reasons, who's also Osage and lives and works in Portland, has also published a piece on her personal blog that's called Native Science.
And she also is coming on to the Old Mole Variety Hour in November.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, make sure to seek out Osage voices. There's a diversity of opinions on it. And there's a diversity of broader Indigenous opinions on the film, as we're seeing. So that's sort of how I want to ground my response to it, is as a person who studied the trends in Indigenous representation since Native people started appearing in film, which is basically within the origins of film. Some of the first short films created by the Edison Company were recordings of traditional Indigenous dances. So basically, as soon as movies have been made, Indigenous peoples have been in the movies with varying degrees of equitable and fair representational practices.
You smile. And of course, you one area of your scholarship is ethnography. So you've been interested in attempts, including perhaps Scorsese's attempts, to bring some ethnographic validity to the representations of the Osage people. You want to continue in that direction? Because Scorsese has been praised for bringing his team into extensive consultation in the Osage community and aiming for a level of authenticity that he feels is a corrective to the distorted place that Native people have in the film imaginary and popular culture. Mm-hmm. Do you want to begin with that aspect of the film that's been both praised and criticized on that front?
Yeah, so to sort of paint a broad picture of Indigenous representation in cinema, one of the earliest examples of Native sort of ethnographic cinema is a film like Nanook of the North, which was made in the 1920s by Robert Flaherty. It's largely discussed as a documentary. But if you look further into the history of that film, you realize that so-called Nanook, that's not the name of a person, was a character played by Inuit man named Alok Arialok. And that behind the scenes, even though Flaherty was claiming he was the kind of auteur, that Inuit people were consulting with him on storyboarding that film. They were operating the camera. They were guiding him, right, to different shots. So this structure of consultation with Native tribes is a longstanding technique that filmmakers have participated in when they've been making movies about Indigenous peoples. It's gotten better in terms of the transparency around consultation, right? Robert Flaherty did consultation, but then, you know, didn't really tell us about it when he made the film. And I think that in terms of Scorsese's approach to it, you know, consulting with tribes, hiring folks within the community to design costumes and props, you know, infusing the local economy in that way, working with language consultants. I think one of the really compelling elements of the film that I found was the use of the Osage language. I think it was treated like the way any other language would be treated in film, because I think oftentimes Indigenous language gets sort of exoticized. The long history of Indigenous representation in cinema, oftentimes, you know, Native languages will go untranslated, or there's to some hilarious ends instances where the Native actors would be speaking and saying one thing in their Native language, and it would get translated to something else. There's a very famous clip, if you watch the film Real Injun, there's a scene where they have some Native actors speaking, I believe it was Navajo, and they're basically making fun of the whole movie, but the what gets translated is not what they're saying. So I think there are a lot of admirable qualities to Scorsese's approach. I think the film was, you know, beautifully shot. The sound design was amazing. You know, it's a high production value film, and it is a prominent place for a lot of Indigenous craftsmanship to get, you know, showcased. I think Lily Gladstone killed it. And if she doesn't, you know, get an Oscar for this, I'll take to the streets. But
can you say a little bit about her character of Molly, and about the drama, which is in part love affair and part a story of betrayal and corruption and violence, and where she's kind of caught in the embrace of a man who's destroying her. So it has this real tragic unfolding horror to it. Can you say a bit about her character and the relationship with Ernest Burkhart, which is basically the central drama of the story, as I understood it?
Just to clarify to you, I believe Lily uses she and they pronouns, or they and she pronouns. So I'll try to use both. So Lily portrays the character of Molly Burkhart. The way that the film is set up is that it kind of focuses on the character of Ernest Burkhart, who in real life, you know, married into the Osage community, and then proceeded to systematically kill all of the people around Molly, her family, her sisters, and then attempt to kill Molly herself in a scheme to inherit the head rights to the oil land that she, you know, owned. Also, Lily, you know, had been deemed incompetent, meaning that she was incapable of managing her own finances. And so in some ways it was advantageous for her to enter into a relationship with Ernest, because then she, you know, she didn't have to have someone to look out for her money. Ernest could, her husband could be the kind of one that could facilitate that. She didn't have to go to like a third party, as much as, you know, marrying a horrible, murderous, lying bastard can be, right? Her portrayal was just, Lily's portrayal, what they brought to that character was just so strong and generous and compassionate. And they do this in many of their other roles. She has also portrayed beautiful characters in Reservation Dogs. And I was glad to see that Scorsese noted that, you know, once he started consulting with the Osage, he had kind of decided to shift how the narrative was structured. Initially, Leonardo DiCaprio was supposed to play the Jesse Plemons character, who was an FBI agent. And once he talked to the Osage and realized he wanted to kind of ground the story more through their experiences, it made sense to sort of switch to the perspective of Ernest. I think, you know, a lot of people, when we heard that story, were hoping that we would get more insight from the character of Molly. And we do get some voiceovers and we do get some scenes with her. But I think overall, the film still mostly sort of follows the story from the perspective of Ernest, you know, the white character. And so while we get more insight into how the Osage were, you know, responding to this crisis, this genocidal crisis, I think it's still a different movie than if, say, we centered the experiences of Molly and her sisters and Molly and her family, because there's some things that we don't get to see from Ernest's perspective. And that makes sense, because I think he's still kind of an outsider that fully doesn't sort of comprehend what's going on with the Osage.
Do you think the film is too empathizing with the character? Of course, Leonardo DiCaprio is a captivating actor and probably a big budget item in this film, along with Robert De Niro. But his moral unfolding at times drew the audience in ways that felt it was a bit too forgiving of him. And of course, you see Molly seemingly blind to him until there's a triumphant moment at the end, at the risk of a spoiler, when she sees him most clearly through the lens of a courtroom scene. But it seemed in the book there was more of Molly's anguish and outrage, and she seemed very much a stoical character. And is there a, you know, that's also a trope or a stereotype of the noble, stoical native who endures the assaults and attacks and kind of occupies a spiritual plane above it all. And I was wondering about your take on that, although, of course, her character was riveting and kind of the center in many ways of the film and the moral conscience of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be, I think if we wanted to tell a story about this incident from Molly's perspective, I think we would need an Osage director to do that. Right. And so for me, it makes sense that Scorsese sort of grounds the story in this kind of like outsider white guy perspective, in a character that is, you know, morally in the wrong, because a lot of his films sort of are exploring the psyche, like how do these people become who they are? How do they get caught up in these kinds of, like, you know, to quote Psycho, these like personal traps, right? These personal mazes of their own building. And so for me, it makes sense that Scorsese, you know, grounds the film in this perspective, because I think it's, for lack of a better term, it's like one of the more ethical choices that he could have made. I think if he were trying to direct this film from a native perspective, that would be more hazy ethical grounds.
There's this whole storytelling rights that people talk about. Who has the right to tell what kind of story?
And I think anyone can tell any story. We're not talking about the law, but I think, you know, what are, you know, storytelling practices that are attend to the histories and the current conditions that Indigenous people exist in. And I think if there's one thing I want to sort of bring up around this conversation that has kind of exploded about the film, is that I really, really hope people start taking seriously Indigenous directed and written and led stories and supporting those stories. Because when people come out and say, you know, well, no one would have given a Native person $300 million to make a movie about this, they are correct, and they are pointing to deeper structural problems within the film industry, and I think within American culture more broadly, that Indigenous art is not being supported in the way that it needs to be supported, especially if we're moving towards reconciliation and reparation with Indigenous communities. I think there are models for Indigenous filmmaking that exist in all other places. There's a really robust Indigenous filmmaking world in Aotearoa in New Zealand. Way up north, there's, you know, really successful Inuit produced films. And so this consultation and kind of collaboration model has been around for a long time. And I think what we see in Killers of the Flower Moon is the kind of like apex of that kind of model. And I think in terms of the problems and the limitations of the film that people are seeing, I think that sort of shows, right, that there are limitations to this model. And if we do want deeper forms of Indigenous storytelling, we need to start really taking seriously funding Indigenous stories and centering Indigenous, you know, voices and creatives, putting Indigenous people in charge of these projects at the highest level.
Yeah, so you're saying there are limits to what Scorsese could do through this film. And I did think the ending was a very profound departure from conventional narrative, certainly the, you know, the white savior genre that we're familiar with, of who comes in to save the day, or even romantic portrayals of other heroes that resolve a conflict by film's denouement. And instead, we have this a radio play at the end that's also based on history, and a very profound way in which Scorsese himself comes in to honor Molly, the protagonist that's so part of this, central to the history, Molly Kyle, and the ongoing debt to Indigenous people beyond the Osage. Do you want to say anything about that ending?
Yeah.
Without going into too much detail, but that's part of the problem of doing film analysis. Mm-hmm. So much about how our approach to film critique or film analysis depends on how the film resolves the dilemmas it sets up. So we have a dilemma there in how you talk about endings and the phobia around spoilers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. So spoilers, folks familiar with the story will sort of know what happens. It stays pretty, close to the histories of the book. So there's two parts to the ending. The first part is this kind of radio play, which I read as this kind of like self-questioning moment for Scorsese, right? Because it's this all-white cast performing a history of the Reign of Terror, performing a version of the story that we have just watched.
For a white audience.
Yeah. For a white audience, yes. And obviously, Scorsese is aware, right, of this long history of white people either portraying Indigenous peoples or portraying Indigenous stories without being accountable to Indigenous communities in the ways that they ought to. He appears, right, and, reads a statement about the resolution of the case directly addresses the audience. I read that as, this kind of self-reflexive moment of Scorsese saying, did I or did I not just do exactly the thing I wasn't supposed to do? I don't know. I appreciate that because I have seen such sort of self-reflexive moments in other places in film history. So I guess I'll leave it at that. But I do think that this is a very self-aware film. And then the second part of the ending is that it cuts to contemporary Osage people at a gathering and slowly zooms out. And I was able to go see the film at the Hollywood Theater. I coordinated a Native community screening. Hollywood was able to donate, 30 tickets to us. And then I funded another 30 tickets. And I was really glad I could see the movie in a theater with a lot of other Native people. And it was also really nerve-wracking because I didn't know what the film was going to be, and I didn't also know if audience members were going to react in ways that were appropriate and responsible to Indigenous people. And I think everyone did a good job. Everyone behaved themselves. But one thing, I was really glad at that ending of that shot of contemporary Osage people, because I was reminded that even though there are these horrific chapters in Osage history and similar chapters in many other Indigenous people's histories, that we're still here and that we're still in modernity, and we didn't disappear like we were supposed to, right? And we are still all able to occupy the theater together and be together in that way. But then also, as the, you know, camera zooms out and you see, you know, more and more sort of green space, you're also reminded that there were supposed to be more of us here, right? We were supposed to fill that theater. And so it was a very important ending. And I think perhaps I'm reading it from an Indigenous angle. I don't know if non-Native viewers had the same thought when they saw that, or if that was also Scorsese's intention to, you know, point out the absence of Indigenous peoples in the face of our, you know, refusal to die, as settler colonialism wants us to do. But yeah, I found the ending of the film thoughtful and self-aware. And again, there are lots of good qualities to the film, but in the end, I am ready for Indigenous stories, and I think a lot of Indigenous folks are also ready for Indigenous stories, and I hope that more people will help support us in telling those stories moving forward.
And Kaylee Simmons, I hope you continue to come on to the Old Mole Variety Hour to tell those stories and offer commentary and not only praise or applause, but analyses like you've been able to provide today. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Once again, this is Jan Hawken talking with Dr. Kaylee Simmons, Professor of Indigenous Nation Studies at Portland State University.
As you see fit. If I thought you were sent by the Creator, I might be induced to think you had a right to dispose of me. Do not misunderstand me, but understand me fully with reference to my affection for the land. I never said the land was mine to do with as I choose. The one who has a right to dispose of it is the one who has created it. I claim a right to live on my land and accord you the privilege to return to yours.
That was some music from Robbie Robertson, the Canadian musician, also of Cayuga and Mohawk ancestry, who died earlier this year. The song is Words of Fire, Deeds of Blood from his 1994 album Music for Native Americans, made with the First Nations group, the Red Road Ensemble. Before that, we heard Jan Hawken talking with Indigenous Nations Studies scholar Dr. Kaylee Simmons about the film Killers of the Flower Moon. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and on this pre-Halloween episode, we are considering some of the monstrous horrors of our world. We turn now to Patricia Kullberg with some readings on background to recent events in the Middle East.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg bringing you some perspectives on the Middle East crisis that you might not encounter in the mainstream media. Right now, it is difficult to uphold the idea that every nation has the right to exist in peace and freedom without being accused of supporting anti-Semitism, terrorism, or genocide. While insisting on these universal rights, we should also seek to understand what drives the conflict. Some analysts argue that behind the current outbreak of violence lies the neocolonial strategy of suppressing progressive voices in favor of extremist regimes that the U.S. or its proxies can either crush or control. Mehdi Hassan, author and commentator, takes a deeper look at the rise of Hamas as a creature of Israel's own making. Here is a brief excerpt from his 2018 article in The Intercept titled, How Israel Went from Helping Create Hamas to Bombing It. He writes, What do you know about Hamas? That it's sworn to destroy Israel? That it's a terrorist group? That it rules Gaza with an iron fist? That it's killed hundreds of innocent Israelis with rocket, mortar, and suicide attacks? But did you also know that Hamas would probably not exist today were it not for the Jewish state? That the Israelis helped turn a bunch of fringe Palestinian Islamists in the late 1970s into one of the world's most notorious militant groups? Listen to former Israeli officials, such as Brigadier General Yitzhak Segev, who was the Israeli military governor in Gaza in the early 1980s. Segev later told a New York Times reporter that he had helped finance the Palestinian Islamist movement as a quote-unquote counterweight to the secularists and leftists of the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Fatah Party led by Yasser Arafat. Hamas, to my great regret, is Israel's creation. Avner Cohen, a former Israeli religious affairs official who worked in Gaza for more than two decades, told the Wall Street Journal in 2009. Cohen even wrote an official report to his superiors warning them not to play divide and rule in the occupied territories by backing Palestinian Islamists against Palestinian secularists. To be clear, first the Israelis helped build up a militant strain of Palestinian political Islam in the form of Hamas. Then the Israelis switched tack and tried to bomb, besiege, and blockade it out of existence. That was an excerpt from a piece by Mehdi Hassan from The Intercept. Stephen Zunis, writing in The Progressive on October 11, details further how the U.S. has all along pursued strategies to buttress Israel's apartheid state in Palestine with deadly consequence in both Israel and Palestine. His article is titled, Hamas, Israel, and the U.S. Have Learned Nothing. Zunis writes, The killing of more than 1,000 Israelis and internationals from rockets and direct attacks by Hamas is a staggering blow for Israel, a small country which has repeatedly been a victim of violent attacks throughout its history. But Hamas, once again, has failed to recognize that killing civilians is not just morally reprehensible, but politically counterproductive. The terror inflicted upon Israel will only harden Western support for the country and make it easier to depict Palestinians as somehow collectively guilty of atrocities against Jewish people. It will also make it easier to rationalize Israel's ongoing denial of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, as well as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to consolidate dictatorial power through control of the judiciary. It is unlikely there will be a resumption of the massive pro-democracy demonstrations we've seen on the streets of Tel Aviv this year. While the Biden administration was certainly correct to condemn the attacks in strongest possible terms, it was incorrect in saying that they were unprovoked. Israeli forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem have bulldozed hundreds of Palestinian homes, confiscated Palestinian farming and grazing land, destroyed orchards and vineyards, engaged in arson attacks against Palestinian properties, and violated Muslim holy places. Israelis have killed scores of Palestinian civilians since 2022, and Hamas had been warning it would retaliate if they continued. When the Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, the secular nationalist Palestine Liberation Organization unilaterally recognized Israel and renounced the armed struggle in the hopes that Israel would allow for the creation of a Palestinian state. Hamas angrily opposed the agreement, arguing that the PLO was naive to think that Israel, with the United States as the chief mediator in the peace process, would allow for a viable Palestinian state to emerge. As Israeli colonization of the West Bank and political repression increased, and as the PLO-led Palestinian Authority became increasingly inept and corrupt, support for Hamas grew. The failure of the United States to be an honest broker and its ongoing insistence on providing unconditional support to Israel's increasingly right-wing governments seemingly vindicated Hamas's skepticism. In the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections, Hamas captured a plurality of the vote and eventually seized control of Gaza. They have ruled the enclave ever since, effectively banning any political opposition. Between 2008 and 2023, 78 Israeli civilians and 2,789 Palestinian civilians were killed in clashes between Israel and Hamas. Despite this skewed ratio, successive U.S. administrations and large bipartisan majorities in Congress have denounced Hamas's attacks while defending Israel's killing of Palestinian civilians, insisting that it was all in self-defense. Just as the lives of Israeli civilians were expendable in the eyes of Hamas, the Biden administration and a large bipartisan majority of Congress, like the Israeli government, may prove to be similarly dismissive of the lives of Palestinian civilians. That was Stephen Zunis, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, writing in The Progressive. Before that, you heard excerpts from a piece by commentator and author Mehdi Hassan, published in The Intercept. Links to the full articles are published on the webpage for this episode of The Old Mole. I'm Patricia Kohlberg for The Old Mole Variety Hour.
I'm exhausted. Last night I couldn't sleep, but when I did, I could hear bombs in my dreams. Nightmare situation, how could they be so evil? Making mortars out of children and innocent people. We expect the bombs, not knowing where next. Huddle in the corner of my room, trying to protect my little brother as the building shakes like it's possessed. But nothing stronger than the will of the oppressed. I bomb back with my lyrics and rhymes, living the times, trying to break the Palestinian minds. What's hiding in the clouds hanging over my head? My dad risks his life outside to buy bread.
That was MC Abdul rapping Shouting at the Wall, recorded in 2021 when he was 12 years old, about the experience of previous Israeli bombardments of Gaza. Before that, we heard Patricia Kohlberg sharing readings about the entangled history of Hamas, Israel, and the U.S. Before we close today, I want to share some material from the People's CDC from earlier this month. They have a statement on Palestine, a call to action, and a guide to making protests more accessible. As activists engaged in the fight against the COVID pandemic and for public health and health equity, we mourn the loss of life everywhere, regardless of nationality. We are outraged at the possibility that Israel, after making life unbearable and unhealthy for Palestinians for generations, has forcibly evicted and is threatening the lives of 1.1 million Palestinians in Gaza, as it has chronically done with those in the West Bank and Palestinian citizens of Israel. Nothing in any history of any armed conflict ever could justify such collective punishment of a civilian population, nor will such actions keep Israelis safe. Palestinian liberation is a disability justice issue. Gaza has had a healthcare system near the breaking point for decades. Israel controls Palestinians' mobility, uses disablement as a weapon of occupation, and has refused to distribute vaccines to Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. The current genocide will worsen the spread of COVID-19 and other communicable disease. There can be no disability justice under settler colonialism. If you are going to be in the streets in support of Palestine, please wear a mask. If you are organizing a protest, please require and distribute masks and urge people to stay home if sick. Masks keep the movement safer, more accessible, and more sustainable. That's from the People CDC. I want to extend my appreciation to the comrades who've been providing N95 and KN95 respirator masks at recent protests in Portland. You can find links to the full call and statement from the People CDC, as well as a link to their latest guide on making protests more accessible on the webpage for this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can find also the rest of the Old Mole available for listening, downloading, and subscribing at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And remember, you can support KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station, by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. I'm Fran Michelle, and I've been your host for today's Old Mole, with many thanks to Patricia Kullberg for her well-read read, to Bill Resnick and his guest, Jennifer Berkshire, to Jan Hocken and her guest, Kaylee Simmons, to Patricia Kullberg again and Denise Morris for editing, and to you, the listeners and supporters of KBOO. The Old Mole will be back next Monday with more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's ground roots perspective. We'll go out with more music from Robbie Robertson's album, Music for the Native Americans. This is the song, Ghost Dance.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning.